This is The Record on KUOW. Welcome, I'm Bill Radke. This city, quote, can't afford another decade of the same failed policies on homelessness. It's time we commit to tackling homelessness once and for all. As mayor, I will end street homelessness by 2020. Those are the words of former California State Senator Mark Leno, who yesterday was one of two top vote getters in San Francisco's mayoral election. Since Seattle is also a West Coast big city run by progressive Democrats, expensive city, lots of homelessness, we would like to know what San Francisco's mayor might do and whether we ought to do that here. So with me is Marisa Lagos, KQED politics reporter and co-host of the Political Breakdown podcast. Welcome, Marisa.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, we have Danny Westing, who's a columnist at Seattle Times and who's writing about homelessness, among other things. Good to see you, Danny.
Hi, Bill. Thanks.
And Sarah Rankin is a Seattle University professor and director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
So well, I want to start with you, Marisa, in San Francisco. This election is too close to call. The top vote getters are, as I mentioned, Mark Leno and a city supervisor, London Breed. Let's start with the quote I just read. How would Mark Leno end street homelessness by 2020?
Well, he put out a pretty detailed 11-page plan partway through this very truncated campaign, which happened after our mayor, Ed Lee, died suddenly in December. You know, it's funny, of the candidates for mayor, I think there was a lot of similar tone struck around homelessness, but I think Leno's plan was probably the most detailed. One of the things he'd like to do is make use of what city officials estimate are 1,500 vacant single-room occupancy units. Those are those residential hotels that usually don't have a kitchen, but, you know, let people kind of be more transitional, I think you could say. He wants to put 1,000 people into those basically as soon as possible. He's talking about expanding these navigation centers that we've seen where folks can go in and bring all of their stuff with them, right? Tents and dogs and whatever they need, as opposed to the shelters, which are a lot more strict and I think have turned some people off. And then a litany of other things, including a mental health justice center, so that folks who are homeless and are potentially being put into jail more for their homelessness and mental health issues than, you know, for actual serious crimes, could get some help.
And what keeps San Francisco from doing all those things now?
I mean, a lot of them are being done. I think we have seen an explosion in California of homelessness, and this is a statewide issue. It's really been exacerbated in places like LA with, you know, the sort of downside of such an economic expansion is the high cost of living here, and especially around housing. I think Ed Lee, our former mayor, was not as laser focused on this as our mayor before that, Gavin Newsom, who did succeed in housing thousands of folks. But we've seen just so many people become homeless in recent years. And I think that that is something, you know, that whoever the next mayor is going to be a lot more focused on than Ed Lee was, who was really looking at economic expansion coming out of the recession.
Okay, we'll talk more about, I guess, more specific reasons not to do those things, if there are. But first, I want to know the other front runner, London Breed. These two candidates are pretty much neck and neck. How is London Breed's plan different about homelessness?
You know, I think a lot of what she's proposing is in the same vein as Leno. I don't believe her plan was quite as detailed. People I talked to who have worked on this issue for a long time feel like it was a little bit more of a grab bag. And I think she has sort of waffled a little bit in terms of how sort of compassionate she wants to be. In recent weeks, she talked a lot about clearing all the homeless encampments and centralizing folks in one sort of main shelter navigation center type place, which when you talk to people who've worked on this issue just poses all kinds of issues, some of them legal, right? You can't put people with restraining orders in the same area as people who are domestic violence victims, for example. And I think that her backing by the business community and folks who are sort of more moderate by San Francisco and probably Seattle standards means that she is a little bit more willing or would be more willing to sort of clear out these encampments and do things that a lot of folks who actually work with homeless people say maybe, you know, solves the problem for the day, but not longer term.
Okay, let's find out more about what the top San Francisco mayoral candidates are wanting to do. What questions do you have, Professor Rankin, Seattle University? What do you want to know about San Francisco before we talk about Seattle's approach?
I don't know that I have as many questions as I do
you know, sort of reflections on what we're doing here in Seattle and how it compares.
Okay, we're going to get there. Danny Westnate, Seattle Times. Do you want to know more about San Francisco?
Well, I do, because we have always been San Francisco's little sister, if you will. They do everything pretty much before we do, from skyrocketing rents to homelessness crises, everything. And so whatever their, I mean, I've noticed from afar that their politics seems to have shifted at least incrementally to the right of ours on this issue. The current mayor, who is temporary and wasn't running for the election, I believe, has also said, oh, we're going to sweep the Mission District of all homelessness, and just a lot more aggressive language about, at least from afar, I get the sense that it's become a more sort of boiling issue down there. And obviously that's happening here in Seattle as well. So I'm just fascinated that in an election that these candidates, I mean, you have someone who said they're going to end homelessness by 2020. That shows how desperate people are for someone with a plan, because there is no way in hell he's going to end homelessness by 2020.
Was it homelessness or chronic homelessness?
Because street homelessness was his quote.
Right. There's a big difference. And there's a lot of work, actually, that's shown that specific interventions on focusing on chronic homelessness are extremely effective. And so, in fact, it's one of the most rigorously studied forms of intervention. So I think there's reason for optimism. I can't put a timeline on it like that. but I can say that if this particular candidate is looking at programs like Built for Zero, which the New York Times recently just covered in an op-ed piece, it's been around for a while, and they focus on ending chronic homelessness or veterans homelessness. They've got 77 communities that are part of that work. And a significant number of those communities have reached what they call functional zero in those populations, and a number of others have made significant progress. And that's because those sorts of interventions are really focused on evidence-based practices. So I think there's reason for optimism. I would hope that this particular candidate is looking at partnering in that sort of program, because it's proven to work.
Marisa in San Francisco, KQED, what about Danny's observation that the Democrats, I mean, in San Francisco, the Democrats have been in charge for a long time. So as someone said, the Democrats own the homelessness problem in San Francisco, and we can relate here. What do you see a rightward or a crackdown kind of lurch in San Francisco politics on this issue?
I wouldn't say necessarily. It's true that our interim mayor has cracked down on some of these encampments. You know, he's not elected, and for reasons too complicated to get into, his appointment was sort of a political move by the left to try to head off London Breed's mayoral candidacy, who's now locked in this battle with Mark Leno. You know, I think it's interesting. If you look at the debate here around things related to homelessness, like mental health services and, drug use, one thing we're seeing, I think, is a willingness among the business community, for example, to look at sort of more what you might call out there solutions, like safe injection sites, which of course we have sort of legal issues around, but I'm seeing that, you know, folks who historically didn't even want to touch this, like the Visitors and Convention Bureau, who, you know, in the past have really focused on just making San Francisco like this bright, shiny place and don't talk about the homeless people over there, they've realized that that's not working, that when people come here, this is what they see. And so I do think that you are seeing more of the city kind of engage on this issue. But by the same token, yes, I think there's frustration among people because so much of this has bled into neighborhoods, and it is creating, you know, safety issues around cleanliness, and just it's sad. I mean, I think people are compassionate here. One thing that I did want to note around, you know, a lot of the stuff around street homelessness is so visible. But another thing we are talking a lot more about in San Francisco is keeping families, especially in their homes, because we've seen such an uptick in families being either housing insecure or homeless, to the point where we have a school district, the school district looking at potentially creating a shelter at a school for homeless families. And voters did pass this week an eviction defense fund, so that if people are standing to lose their housing through evictions, the city will actually pay for their legal defense. So I do think that there is a move to kind of look at this more holistically. And like I said, I think whoever the next mayor is, they're going to be more focused on this in a way that we haven't seen in recent years.
Marissa, I'm curious, how do you guys have 1,500 empty SRO rooms? That seems astonishing that they haven't been made use of already.
Yeah, I mean, and then there is some debate over that number. That's from the Department of Building Inspection. I think that, you know, some of it has to do with the private owners of those buildings and what makes sense for them. I don't know that it's going to be as high as 1,500. He's Moreno's putting his as a 1,000. What he says is that a lot of these landlords are leaving the units empty because there aren't supportive services that that these tenants would need to basically stay safe and reliably housed. And so I think some of it would be building up the services around these privately owned buildings so that landlords feel more comfortable renting them out.
Marissa, does zoning affect affordability in San Francisco the way it does in Seattle? We're a single-family dominated city, and there's a lot of talk here about densifying and building up, even in neighborhoods zoned single-family, which is precious to a lot of Seattleites.
Yeah, that's absolutely a huge issue. I mean, if you look at where homelessness is concentrated and the services, it is generally around the downtown area. If you go out to the west side of town, which has historically been single family homes, there's a lot of resistance to building up and building denser. I think some of the ways that even more moderate by San Francisco standards, Democrats have been trying to focus on is, okay, we're not going to upzone, you know, these residential neighborhoods, but let's legalize, say, in-law units, granny units, so that there are more options. And I really do think the broad gamut is being looked at. But this is not a problem we got into overnight, as you guys know, and it's certainly not one that's going to end quickly. And I think that in San Francisco, one of the differences between some of the mayoral candidates is that folks like London Breed are seen as more friendly towards developers, and people on the left see that as kind of a threat, even though, you know, I think we all agree we need more housing. They're worried that we're only going to build luxury housing and there won't be affordable units.
What does that sound familiar? We're talking with Marissa Lagos, KQED politics reporter and co-host of the Political Breakdown podcast. And now we're going to take what we've learned from you and what we know here and just talk about Seattle. Marissa, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
So I have with me both Danny Westneat from the Seattle Times, who is writing about homelessness a lot, and also we have from Seattle University Professor Sarah Rankin, who directs the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project there. So let's talk about our own now. Danny, you wrote about recently about someone who said we need to break some rules if we're going to solve homelessness in Seattle. We are officially in an emergency. It's been declared, what, 3 years ago almost now?
Yeah, 2.5.
Yeah. So what would if it truly were an emergency, a chance, if ever rules can be broken, it's during an emergency. What would be emergency action that would ease homelessness in Seattle?
Well, this particular person I was writing about is in the housing industry, and he was suggesting that they need to waive or streamline or limit or somehow concentrate the level of regulation in the construction of things like what would amount to SROs. I'm, again, astonished that San Francisco has all those SROs.
Is there single-room occupancy?
Yeah, so it's the old, like, down in Pioneer Square, there's that sign that says 75-cent room.
Yes.
That was the old SRO.
Yeah.
And, you know, people who have been involved in homelessness for decades say that was our sort of first-tier affordable housing, and it's mostly gone now. Some of them were horrible fire traps and had code problems, and so there are reasons that they're gone. But so people, this fellow I was writing about was searching for a way to sort of replicate a new SRO using prefab modular housing, and he got a $1 million grant from Paul Allen. And then when they were trying to do it, the city, various agencies would step in and say, oh, you need a electrical transformer for that site, and there's a 9-month waiting period on that. And he was like, what the hell? I thought we were in an emergency, you know? And so there's a disconnect on actually providing SRO-type shelter housing and the regulations to do it. And so that's what they meant by let's act like it's an emergency. The other thing you could do is like what San Diego did, which is put up essentially giant army barrack type tents to try to get, I mean, I view the people living under bridges and cardboard boxes as just a humanitarian catastrophe. And so I get irritated when the no sweeps people say, oh, leave them there, right? But the no sweeps people have a point, which is like sweeping them or moving them doesn't help unless you can say, here's where you can go. And that's the part that we have failed at. We have not created a here's where you can sleep instead.
Professor Rankin, what's your realistic take on emergency action to ease or end homelessness?
Well, I agree with Danny. We're really looking at solving homelessness as a two-handed crisis, where the left hand is the hand that enacts laws and regulations, right, and enforces them, and the right hand is the hand that invests in positive, non-punitive solutions. We always talk about what the right hand is doing, but as long as we're not focusing on what the left hand is doing through the creation and enforcement of laws, then the left hand ends up undoing any progress that the right hand might be making.
So what would you advocate?
Well, I think there's some groups that have fabulous analyses on especially the zoning issues and the regulation issues that Danny's talking about. Sightline is one of them. It's a Pacific Northwest think tank. They've done a ton of work on how zoning and other sort of regulations that make the construction of housing unnecessarily expensive need to be changed. We have a group called Seattle Tech for Housing. It's the number four, Seattle Tech for Housing. They've got a number of different reports that talk about what the left hand is doing with respect to the construction of housing and the negative impact that has on affordability. So that's something I think we need to really get seriously
about.
Yeah,
but sorry to interrupt you, but the construction of housing is a five-year time window. 3 to 5 year time window. And when you've declared an emergency, I mean, I realize when they declared an emergency, they didn't really mean it.
Yeah, I don't think anyone truly means that they meant that literally.
What they meant was send us some money, federal government, which didn't happen. But the problem is symbolically, everyone saw Ed Murray and Dow Constantine saying, we're declaring an emergency, and then nothing really happened. So politically, it's a pretty major problem.
There's long-term solutions.
So I'm talking about, you're talking about affordable housing, which cascades up and down the income ranges. But for the people living in cardboard boxes today under bridges, that's not the issue.
That's true. That's why our Homeless Rights Advocacy Project just recently released 6 reports, 4 of which focus on interim solutions. And it's a delicate balance, right? Because if we focus too much on interim solutions, sometimes we can distract our attention away from those longer-term solutions. And I'll say those longer-term solutions are not very popular with politicians.
Name one.
Permanent supportive housing, bringing housing first to scale. This is one of the most rigorously studied interventions. It's shown consistently to be the most cost-effective way of dealing with chronic homelessness.
What's unpopular about it?
Well, a couple of different
things. Really expensive.
It's
cost-effective, yet really expensive.
They put it in their head tax plan. You do have to give them some credit for that, right?
Well, it depends on what the spending plan ends up being, right? Because that's still sort of up in the air. But it's actually not expensive if you think of the alternative. What's the most expensive is to leave people who are chronically homeless on the street. We know that. That's been documented repeatedly.
You accept that, Danny?
Well,
happy to share the studies.
I believe you, and I know all about 1811 East Lake and Bill Hobson's. I mean, that's essentially what those studies showed, is that you take the chronic street alcoholics off the street, even at a cost of whatever to build them housing.
But those are just a drop in the bucket of a voluminous, group of studies that all show the same thing.
I know, but this is not the way politicians think about the world.
That is true.
And their problem is that they chose, I think, wrongly to do this head tax. The head tax is a bad idea, but we probably don't want to get into that.
Later. Come back.
But they needed a source of revenue, and fair enough. And then they're like, okay, we're doing this radioactive thing, which is levying a new tax, and now we have to figure out what to do with the money. And some of the housing first options are up front the most expensive, and so they eat up all the money.
I'm going to give Professor Rankin the last word because we're going to talk more about this later. But yes, final thoughts, Professor.
We're in a very polarized conversation about housing and homelessness. There's sort of people who are for things like the head tax and people who are against it. I'm really interested in looking for a third door. And our group actually has started a conversation with a number of businesses who are extremely interested in investing in permanent support of housing, because you see a confluence of interest between homeless rights advocates who want to see people housed and businesses that want to see street homelessness gone. And so to the extent that other businesses, we've been really working hard with a number of really interested businesses, I would invite others to contact us because we're facilitating those discussions right now.
We've been telling you what the Democrats in San Francisco are talking about doing regarding homelessness. They just had a mayoral election there yesterday, too close to call. And we've been talking about what Seattle ought to do, as we will continue to do. Danny Westneat, Seattle Times columnist. Sarah Rankin, Seattle U professor, director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks so much.
Back with The Record on KUOW in a moment. Here on KUOW, we've told you about the new youth detention center going up in Seattle. We've covered the activists fighting to stop it from being built. What would happen inside that building? Well, for one thing, the county runs a diversion program called a peacemaking circle. It made headlines last year when a young participant was charged with murder after completing the process. In a moment, we're going to talk with the chief prosecutor for the King County Juvenile Division. Jimmy Hung is one of the people behind the Peacemaking Circle program. But first, what happens in these things? KUOW reporter Patricia Murphy sat in on a Peacemaking Circle earlier this year. Welcome, Patricia.
Hey, Bill. Thanks.
Sounds a little new agey to some people, as one caller told us yesterday on KUOW. But if I were to sit in on a Peacemaking Circle tomorrow, what would I see?
Well, what you do in a peace circle is you actually do sit in a circle. There are some ceremonial elements that are part of the circle. There's a talking stick. There's some sage that you burn to cleanse the space and yourself before you talk amongst yourselves and in a group. It's really a space for healing.
A space for healing. Mm-hmm. And what is that the only goal, is healing?
Not necessarily. I think what you're trying to do in this peace circle and what the guy who runs them does very effectively is create an intimate space of escalating intimacy between a group of, in my case, about 15 people. So you're creating this space to reflect, to sit with discomfort, to listen and share with each other. And what you're doing is building a really unique, intimate bond with a group of people that you may not really know at all.
So is it giving people space to reckon with what they've done, talk about it?
Depending on what the goal is for that circle, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The goal really first starts with a level of intimacy and trust. And that happens over time, over hours and over days. And that's really important.
Even the chief prosecutor, Jimmy Hung, said it was hard for him to describe. And why is that?
It really is hard to describe. I had a similar experience because it's a sacred space, because you have created something so unique with the participants. And you've also agreed not to share, right, what happened in that circle with the participants. It's hard to explain to people. I remember trying to talk to my sister about it, and she was like, I don't even know what you mean. But it was profound.
Well, what is one story from your time there that you can relate to us that really stuck with you?
There was an exercise that we did in this circle where we were all instructed, and we didn't know why, to hold our outstretched arm with a water bottle in our hand. So a full water bottle, your arm outstretched, and you're allowed to do that for as long as you wanted to. And then whenever you wanted to, you could put that water bottle down. And it was interesting because, well, it said a lot about the personality. Some people were like, I'm going to hold on to this forever. And some people were like, I'm not going to be the first one. And this is all going on in your head.
Yeah.
But what you did when you put that water bottle down, it was an exercise about holding on to pain. And it was an instruction in the fact that pain becomes a presence in your body. Because, of course, the longer you hold that water bottle, the more difficult it becomes, and the pain spreads, and eventually you put it down. So this was a lesson in making the choice to let go of pain. You can put it down when you want to. And that's something that really stuck with me.
Mm. Well, let's talk more about peacemaking circles and how they relate to justice and detention in King County. I've been talking with KUOW reporter Patricia Murphy. Thanks, Patricia.
Thanks, Bill.
Letting go of pain, dropping the emotional water bottle, not something maybe you traditionally associate with the criminal justice system. King County juvenile prosecutor Jimmy Hung joined me earlier this month to explain. He's been a prosecutor for 20 years, starting in adult courts, and he told me the story of what led him to give peacemaking circles a try. He had just been asked to lead the county's juvenile unit, and he says he was a little scared because he had never practiced there, so he thought he'd spend some time in the courtroom to get a feel for it.
The courtrooms are pretty small there, and so there's only this back row. And I remember I was sitting there, and there was a man about my age who was sitting there as well. And I remember they called the case, and they walked the young juvenile respondent into the courtroom, and she was wearing the blue jumpsuit that they all wear. And she was this blonde, white, young girl who was about 13 years old. And she sat in her chair, and I noticed how her feet didn't touch the ground. She was in front of the court because she was violating the conditions of her supervision, and the reason she was doing that was she wasn't staying at home and following the rules of her father. And so the father got up in court and in front of his daughter told the judge how he didn't want his daughter living with him anymore and wanted the system to ship her back to Wisconsin to live with her mom. And the young girl was sobbing and crying about how she didn't want to live in Wisconsin and she had nothing there and she wanted to be with her dad, but her dad was in open court telling everyone that he didn't want his daughter anymore. And the reason he didn't want his daughter anymore that he cited was that she was bringing grown men into their home and having sex with them. And I just sat there thinking to myself, what is going on here? We have this 13-year-old girl who is sobbing, and we have this system that is forcing her father to declare in open court that he doesn't want his daughter and to tell everyone that she's being victimized by other grown men. And I just thought about the trauma that it was causing in this young girl. And so that was a very vivid example for me about how our system can be stuck in processes that make sense to the grown-ups in the room, but oftentimes we lose sight of the young people that we profess to be trying to help or to try and address and what we're doing in the system that perpetuates the trauma that they've already endured. And so that was just one experience that was probably the seed that got me thinking that maybe we can do this better. And so that's how I arrived at, hey, maybe we should try peacemaking circles.
Do you know what happened to this girl?
You know, a year or two later, I saw her back in the system, and at that time, she had been squarely identified as a young girl who was being trafficked in our community. She looked older for sure and definitely looked like she had lived a life a lot longer than her age.
Mm. Did you ever think about whether the work you're doing could have helped her somehow?
Yeah, you know, I think about it. In a lot of the work that we've done with peacemaking circles, it hasn't just brought healing or accountability to young people who are engaged in the system, but I think about the parents of this young girl and what might have happened in their lives that put them in a position where they either thought they didn't want to or were incapable of caring for their own daughter. And I know that in the cases that we've piloted peacemaking circles on in juvenile court, some of the most miraculous things haven't been with the young person who caused harm, but with the parents of the people trying to support this young person, and how in one case, engaging in the peacemaking circle process brought a divorced parents back together as friends who could be positive supporters for their son. And so I don't know really anything about this young girl's parents in the case that I talked to you about, but I think about like the power of how peacemaking circles can bring healing in a lot of contexts. And so possibly it could have helped that family, but I would have liked to have seen what it could have done, because whatever happened in the courtroom that I saw that day, I don't think brought a lot of healing and brought a lot of good to the life of that young person, the life of the parents or our community as a whole. I think a lot of people walked out of that traumatized. I certainly did. I think the participants, the attorneys, the judge could not have walked out of that courtroom feeling very good about what we did.
Sometimes peacemaking circles are talked about as an alternative to youth detention. We've got this King County trying to build a new juvenile justice center, and people who do say that they don't want this new juvenile justice center say that it's just investing in a system that unfairly targets youth of color. They want construction to stop. This is one of the organizers, the attorney and poet Nikita Oliver.
What we're talking about is investing in a future that does not use detention or punishment, punitive punishment, as a way of moving young people into a healthier place in society. And so when we say no new youth jail, we're talking about not building a new detention facility. We are talking about truly investing, taking that $230 million and instead putting it into our imaginations to build a world that is zero detention.
Prosecutor Jimmy Hung, zero detention. That's the King County stated that as a goal. Do you think that should be the goal?
Sure, it should be the goal, just like our goal for our world should be peace, right? I think zero youth detention should be our North Star. I think any healthy community should be a community that doesn't lock up children. But our community is not healthy right now. And so for me, in May of 2018, unfortunately and sadly, we do need a juvenile detention facility, because there are young people who are engaging in such dangerous and serious behavior that jeopardizes our community's safety and their own safety. And in a large sense, we need this facility for their own good. And so if we need a facility, the question then becomes, should the facility be one that is respectful and designed in a way that can provide the best services and intervention for these young people and families that need help? And I think we do need that. The current facility is just frankly rather deplorable. I think that we have people use it. In the wintertime, there's no heating in the facility. In the summertime, there's no air conditioning. The water runs brown in the facility. And so if we're talking about a system of justice and a system that we ask community members to engage in and in some ways force them to engage in my opinion, we should treat them with as much respect as we would want our own loved ones to be treated. And right now, the building is just not very respectful.
I mentioned a young man who went through a peacemaking circle, and he had been convicted of two robberies. And in that peacemaking circle, he said he was sorry. He hoped that he could be forgiven. What he didn't tell you was that he had, allegedly, he's accused of having killed someone that he's since been charged with, that first-degree murder. Do you count that as a failure?
It was a tragedy. I think, when someone says, well, that was a failure, sometimes I have to think, well, compared to what, right? Reflecting back on my career, there have been countless times where I did my job as well as anyone could have done and locked someone away for committing a crime for a very long period of time, only to find out that they got out and killed somebody. And no one ever came to me and said, well, Jimmy, we should close down the criminal justice system. Yeah. And so it was a situation that we've learned from, and we're going to move forward and apply those lessons and hope that we can begin moving forward in a good way.
What did you learn?
One thing I did learn is it probably reinforced in me the limitations of our traditional system. What was very clear in that young man's life is that the streets are working 24/7,
right,
and the system works 9 to 5, 5 days a week.
Right.
And so it reinforced in my mind that if we want to make meaningful change in the lives of young people in our community, in order to make our community safer, then the solution has to be rooted in that community that can also work 24/7 in support of these young people. And that's what it has to take.
That's King County's Chief Juvenile Prosecutor Jimmy Hung. He is working to support young offenders in choosing a different path. And thanks also to Sarome Fung for coming in and talking with me. He's been leading peacemaking circles for 20 years, first in East Boston and now in King County. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle, and we'll be back in just a moment. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. I remember when I realized there are no grown-ups. I was maybe 8 years old, and I was holding M&Ms in a Dixie cup, and I dropped them, knocked them off the table, and my dog licked them all. And so I didn't want those, but I wanted more. I wanted a new supply of M&Ms. And my dad said, no, you didn't take care of the ones that you had, which is not what I wanted to hear, but I thought, oh yeah, that makes sense. He's a grown-up. He's teaching me a valuable lesson. He's tough but wise. And then my mom turned around and said, Tom, this is home. Home is a place where you can make a mistake and get a second chance. And she even got a little emotional about it. And I thought, oh yeah, she's right. I mean, everybody deserves a second chance, but Dad's right, but Mom's right, which means there's no such thing as what I had thought of as a grown-up, which is somebody who knows the right answers. So that's when I realized there are no grown-ups. My next guest has written a book called There Are No Grown-Ups. You may know her from her bestseller, Bringing Up Bebe, which was about how the French managed to raise well-adjusted children. Pamela Druckerman, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So that was what a grown-up was to me until I was about 8. What did a grown-up used to mean to you?
Let me just say that you're a very early learner if you knew at 8 years old that there were grown-ups, because basically I learned this at 40. I'm very embarrassed. I think I imagine that there were people out there who knew how to do things, who kind of got aerosol into bottles and who could fly airplanes and who knew the kind of ultimate platonic answer to questions. And I kind of needed them to be there. And as I say in the book, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I understand why there are conspiracy theorists, because it's very tempting to think there's this kind of cabal of grown-ups out there who are controlling everything. And even, you know, religion is about, you know, God is the ultimate grown-up. You want him to be there kind of making decisions for you.
Right. We want there to be grown-ups. And did you have any, you said it was not till your 40s, but how did you realize or start to realize that, oh, there are no grown-ups?
I think it was when I became a parent. I started to see that I was just as baffled as I had been before I was a parent, and that I didn't, I was playing this role for my children, but that I didn't really inhabit it in a way.
Would you want your child to know the truth, though? Like, I guess I think my kids want to think that there are grown-ups, and that they would be disturbed if they knew how little I know.
I like the idea that you can put up this united front and kind of trick your kids into thinking they're grown-ups. But given that I've just written a book called There Are No Grown-Ups, the cat is out of the bag for my children.
Yes. So
it's too late for this family.
How has that changed parenting? Do they get that there's no there?
My daughter, who's 12, I think is especially wise. She was just kind of born that way. So she has read some of the book. And every time I have this great revelation, she says, Mommy, it took you 40 years to figure that out. I've kind of known that for a few years already.
Right. Oh, that's probably the real truth. So you still live in Paris. You write, the reason you say you started to figure out there are no grown-ups in your 40s, and a lot of the book is about your aging angst.
Yes.
Which, by the way, I'm in my 50s. I have, you know, I'm losing sympathy for you as I
age. Fabulous.
Yeah. Well, look, I look fabulous. Thank you. That's kind of where your book starts. You were very attached to being looking younger than you are.
Well, that was my superpower, because I wasn't beautiful. I wasn't, you know, I couldn't bank on that, but I always looked much younger than I was. I remember, you know, when I was in my 20s, I still looked like a teenager. I was still carded into my 30s. So I figured the 40s are the age when that really starts to work, when all that matters is if you look young, that's kind of enough. You know, you look young and you're not completely obese, like that cat passes for pretty in the 40s.
Okay.
So that was my plan.
And that was your plan. And how'd that work out?
It stopped working after a while. I thought, isn't it great? Like in the 40s, you finally get the face you deserve. And what I deserve is this kind of youthful glow. And then people started clocking me for a couple extra beats when I'd come to meet them. I went to meet this one friend at a restaurant, and we hadn't seen each other for a while, and he literally looked right past me. He kind of hadn't realized that the middle-aged woman standing in front of him was his old friend.
So do you think that people who... Maybe people in... Do you think that because in your 30s you were taken as younger and you really liked that, did that stop you from having a reckoning with adulthood? Like you had to put it off? You stayed immature because you looked youthful?
I think it helped because you can still, when you look young, you can still get away with sort of acting adorably clueless about which line you're in or what time your appointment was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
But once people start treating you like a grown-up, you can't get away with that. You can't wear the same clothes anymore. You can't wear these ironic T-shirts.
Mm-hmm.
You can't kind of act, you know, if you act clueless, people are confused. They're not kind of charmed by that anymore because it doesn't go with your face.
Yes. So did that force you to grow up?
It did. I think, you know, as you mentioned, I live in France. And, you know, there when everyone started switching from calling me Mademoiselle to calling me Madame, and it happened all at once. It basically, there was this collective switch within the course of a few months. I thought, I've got to kind of grow into this new role. And I kind of gradually did a bit, not completely.
The French have that transition baked right into their language.
Yes. Apparently, we don't say ma'am anymore. We used to.
But yeah.
A lot of language. I interviewed this 40-year-old woman from Rwanda, and she said, at 40 in Rwanda, everyone starts calling you grandma.
From there on out,
from
your
there
grandma.
On out.
Well, that might be a lesson.
Have children early so you can actually be a grandma so it won't be insulting.
Right there, you could literally be a grandma. So what's the French take on aging? I mean, you famously learned from the French parenting style. What have you learned from the French about aging?
Well, so the French helped me pinpoint what my American story about aging was and to understand the difference. That's one of the joys of living abroad is you kind of know yourself better as an American, I think. And the American story is look as young as you can for as long as you can and don't give up. And, you know, eventually it's going to stop working and you can feel like a failure and kind of check out of the game entirely. But, you know, you just have to keep up the fight. I'm from Miami, so the fight is especially ardent there.
Oh.
And the French have, you know, they have Botox there. They have facelifts. They call it le lifting. But their idea is you should look like the best version of the age that you are. And I think just hearing that there's another way of approaching aging, for me, it's more calming. And you can inhabit your own age a little bit more. You don't have to go around saying what I hear a lot of North American women saying, which is, you know, I feel so much younger inside. My outside is just a shell. Mm. You know, I am 65, but I feel 25. And you have this whole disconnect. Or you have this story about how you don't care what anyone thinks anymore. It's great to reach this age where you don't care what other people think, which always felt a little bit sad to me because we're social creatures. We want to engage with other minds and care, at least to a certain extent, what they think.
Well, you say the French, the idea is to be the best version of the age you are, but you also said they have facelifts and Botox. So I'm not
they do.
Following.
I mean, that's a cultural ideal. Not everybody manages to achieve it, but it's in the story there. It's in the narrative. And you have lots of older actresses there who still look great and who are very much kind of sexual creatures. And another thing I looked at were the kind of statistics on sexual behavior. I don't know how much of this I can talk about in public radio, but...
go for it.
Yeah, okay. So I'll talk about it in a clean way. Okay. Basically, women into their 50s and 60s in France stay much more sexually active than American women of the same age groups do. So it turns out when you have this story saying, you know, after age 50, once you hit menopause, you're kind of no longer... sexually interested or interesting to other people, then you actually, that changes your behavior. But when you're in a place where you don't have that cultural story, where the story says, you know what, all people are, sex is just something that people do throughout their lives, even if they have cellulite and wrinkles and whatever, it's just a basic human behavior, then you continue to be sexually active much longer.
Hmm.
So we're ruled by these stories we tell ourselves. So just knowing what the American story is, I think is helpful.
What does aging gracefully mean to you? That's maybe even a cliche. I mean, it's a most common phrase. Midlife crisis and aging gracefully.
Yeah.
So what does aging gracefully mean? Or should we just kick that phrase out altogether?
No, I like that phrase. But it took me a while because I don't want to idealize the French women too much. But I did meet French women who I felt were aging gracefully. And what amazed me is they all kind of looked their biological ages. But you could... they were, as they say it in French, they were comfortable in their own age. They kind of owned it. And they didn't look like they were at war with themselves or kind of in mourning for a previous version of themselves. So you could, they could relax into it and you could see who they are. And that story of who they are and what they know and what's specific to them became part of their beauty. So I think that is what it means to age gracefully, is to kind of be comfortable in your own age. And
but we must be getting something out of our American aging. Is it just purely neurotic and scared, or why do we want to? Why do we age like Americans then?
We age. I mean, we do everything according to the cultural or guided at least by the cultural story. That's how we raise children. That's how we age. That's how we get married. That's how we die. I mean, we are ruled by these.
Why do we like that story? We're into it.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think in America we feel like we can beat things.
Oh.
You know, that there's going to be some new diet or some new trick or some new thing, some new way. We're always looking for the next thing.
Yeah.
And that means we throw out the old thing often. And I think in France, it's an older culture, and they kind of, when they find something that works, they stick with it. They're not looking for the next big thing.
What about midlife crisis? I liked your skepticism that that's even a thing. It's something we tell ourselves happens to us.
It's a story, too. It's the same kind of thing. It kind of came into being in the late 1960s. There was this very obscure academic paper about the midlife crisis, and the phrase kind of caught on. It was this moment in the culture when a lot was changing. You had the women's movement, the civil rights movement, women going back into the workforce. And so this story that if you don't like your life, you can totally transform it, you can change it, you can become something completely new, had this really delicious appeal at that moment, and it caught on. And then you had that book Passages about, and which said, you know, this is a biological fact, it has to happen. The only problem was there was not really any good data on whether it was really happening. And once there was lots of research later into midlife and what happens to people. It turns out that most people don't have a midlife crisis. But the name was so great, the midlife crisis.
Yeah.
The idea was so sticky, so tempting to people that we still have it as a cultural notion, and it spread to other countries and other cultures too.
Yeah, I honestly know what people mean when they say it, and we just move on. I never had a midlife crisis. I don't exactly. You say it's kind of like terrible twos. It's just a phrase that I didn't mind my 2-year-olds.
2-year-olds are fine. Yeah. But then if you don't have a midlife crisis, you also relate to the story because you think, look, I dodged a bullet. I didn't have a midlife crisis. How fantastic for me.
Or I missed the chance to reassess my life, and how pathetic am I for not having a midlife crisis.
But I do think there are people in their 40s and 50s and late 30s. There is a kind of reckoning that goes on where people say, you know what? What am I really good at? Who am I really? Because it's this kind of now or never moment where people have to figure out who they are, because what's the point of pretending at this age?
Yeah.
You know, we're not sort of waiting for some future that's going to come. The future is now.
The book is There Are No Grown-Ups, A Midlife Coming-of-Age Story, and the author is Pamela Druckerman. You have some at the end. You have a list. There could be grown-ups. Here's what a grown-up is, you decided. And I'll just pick off a few. Merge your aspirational and actual selves. What does that mean?
Well, like I said, a lot of people have a kind of reckoning in their 40s. And, you know, they've been telling themselves a story about what they should be and who they are. And, you know, I just noticed with a lot of people that I interviewed for this book, they said, you know what, I'm not really heterosexual, or I'm not really writing a novel, so I'm going to stop pretending that I am and I'm going to do the thing I'm really good at.
Mm-hmm.
And once you do that, and even Jung describes this as happening in the late 30s, it's a kind of relief because you can embrace what you really are. And I think that is a big part of being a grown-up, is just knowing yourself and being yourself.
Know your blind spots.
Yeah.
To me, even believing my own story is a blind spot personally. I'm trying to shed taking my story seriously. But what do you mean by know your blind spots? To me, my whole life is a blind spot. Like whatever story I was telling about myself 5 minutes ago or when I was in my 20s, I just think, who cares?
Yeah.
I am a blind spot.
Well, I don't buy it. I think at a certain point, I mean, part of wisdom is knowing yourself and knowing your own limitations. And And so knowing what you're good at and being able to avoid the things that you're not good at, being honest with yourself, even knowing that you have blind spots, even if you're not fully aware at any moment what those are, it's part of being an adult. It's part of acknowledging who you truly are.
Age spots, blind spots. We're talking with Pamela Druckerman. The book is There Are No Grown-Ups, A Midlife Coming of Age Story. And you are at Elliott Bay tonight?
I am.
7 o'clock.
Yes.
Reading from your book.
With great pleasure.
Yeah. Anything you're planning for that event?
I thought I'd talk a little bit about the making of the book, because it was a growing up process for me to be able to catalog my 40s and figure out what I had learned.
I like the New York Times when they wrote about you. The kicker was, wait till menopause, honey. I mean, there are, you know there are crowds of 50, 60, 70, 80-year-olds waiting to give you their own take.
I can't wait. I tried to write this whole book without mentioning the word menopause, but I ended up throwing it in at the end because I didn't really want to talk about it.
Pamela Druckerman, Elliott Bay tonight at 7 o'clock. Great to meet you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And thank you for listening to The Record today, produced by Amina Alsadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jima Brempong, Jason Pagano. We got help today from Matt Martin. Our social media producer is Bon Huberman. Tomorrow is Social Media Ruining the Outdoors. You can use your Bluetooth speakers to tune in from the hiking trail. Join us that way if you like. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.